Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of 18 in Life, the Pac-10 Hoops podcast. After a little two-week break here, we had Seth and I had some difficulties getting together last week. By the way, my name is Jeff Neusser. I am from CougCenter.com, and my co-host here is Seth Cullen from SportsPressNW.com. That's Sports Press Northwest, the esteemed Sports Press Northwest. And so it's been a couple weeks, and you know, it was funny, you know, when we left off a couple weeks ago, we kind of were like, you know, Arizona's cruising. They were fresh off of beating Washington and seeming to sort of, you know, put a stranglehold on the old conference race there. And then lo and behold, they go to LA and get swept. And all of a sudden, you know, UCLA's got some life, but you know, Arizona got it corrected just in time to go ahead and put a capper on yet another Pac-10 championship. But Seth, sort of one thing that's bouncing through my mind that I'm finding kind of interesting is, you know, when Arizona did it before, and I guess, you know, it probably has to do with, you know, the coaching change and sort of the turmoil with Lou Dolson and everything like that. But, you know, when Arizona won it before, I think like most Pac-10 fans, I just sort of rolled my eyes and, you know, why do I want Arizona to win another championship? It's all Arizona, UCLA, Arizona, UCLA, UCLA, Arizona. But I guess maybe this time it feels a little different for me just because I guess I admire to some degree what Sean Miller's done down there these last couple of years. And I find it somewhat, I guess, I don't know, impressive. You know, I to me, it's, I don't know, I don't feel the same way about Arizona. It doesn't feel like Arizona winning another championship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I completely, I know you're coming from, and I completely agree. It's not, you know, it's not like that whole stretch they had where they would just get great recruit after great recruit after great recruit. I mean, they had just kind of 3 years of three different coaches, and they missed out on a lot of recruits that maybe they in previous years they would have gotten. Abdul Gaddy is an example of someone who had signed with Arizona, and then when Olson left, you know, reneged on that commitment, and a lot of other players did the same. So without, you know, that kind of you know, nationally lauded recruiting class, and on the back of Derek Williams, who was not very highly rated when he came out of high school, who now is a sophomore, has won Pac-10 Player of the Year and gotten Arizona back to the top of the league.
Yeah, and it's sort of fascinating because, you know, one of the things that you mentioned was they sort of got, you know, great recruit after great recruit after great recruit. They would have these, you know, enormous recruiting classes, which always sort of baffled me because I've been to Tucson, and not to put a knock on any of our listeners who, you know, who are, you know, Arizona fans who are in Tucson or whatever. But I guess, I mean, you know, I went to
school. Pullman.
Well, yeah, I mean, I went to school in Pullman. Exactly. And so, you know, if Pullman was pulling in, you know, these top rated recruiting classes, I'd be like, how much cash are they giving away to get these kids to come? I love Pullman, but you know, if I'm a basketball player, I'm not sure that's exactly where I want to be. And you know, so I mean, I you know, it's a testament to Lou Dolson, you know, what he was able to build there, because I'm not, you know, all that fond of Tucson, but you know, that Sean Miller was able to do this. You know, I think we, you know, all agree that the Pac-10 is still somewhat down, but that he was able to do it with really, you know, one top player who was not even, you know, a top, I don't even know if he was a top 150 recruit or not. And if he was darn close to the end of the 150. And so he ends up there, and you look, and you know, when the all conference awards came out, we're recording this on a Tuesday, when they came out yesterday on Monday, one guy on the first and second team from the league champ, which is something that's not, you know, normally, you just don't normally see that, especially when you look at, you know, UCLA got what, three guys on the first team, which is a total debacle. We'll talk about that in a sec. But, you know, they got three guys on the first team. Arizona got one guy on the first and second team. I think that's a testament to both, you know, the job that Sean Miller did, and I think that's a testament to the players. You had a lot of guys who actually were pretty high. If I remember right, Jamel Horn was a pretty highly recruited guy, you know, when he came out. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these guys were fairly well thought of, yet they play a really team style of basketball. They buy into – they're not the greatest defense, but they buy into playing defense hard, most of them, and they buy into sharing the basketball and offense. And that, I think, is a testament both to Miller and to Arizona's players for I guess, being willing to take that step and share the ball and just sort of buy into the everybody shares team success thing.
Well, it seemed like, you know, maybe what you had was, you know, guys who went to Arizona with the expectation that they were going to win and with the desire to win, and you know, willing to go all out to do that. You know, I think, you know, and it, which is in kind of contrast to what we saw, I feel like, at UCLA the last couple of years, where you had a bunch of guys who, like, sort of showed up at UCLA expecting to win games, and it just didn't happen. And now this year, it seems like they really bought into sort of the team concept and played a lot better. But, Derek Williams was not in the Rivals 150. Scout had him ranked the number 32nd best power forward coming out of high school. You know, definitely an example of scouting services going wrong there. But yeah, very impressive from Arizona.
Yeah, and as I'm just sort of looking back, you know, these last couple of years, like we said, they're not exactly bringing in, you know, these huge guys. I mean, last year's recruiting class: Jesse Perry, Jordan Mays, both 3-star guys. Daniel Bejarano, I don't know what his story is, but he hasn't played for them this year. He was a 4-star guy. Mm-hmm. You know, going the year back behind that, 2009, that would have been Derek Williams' class. You know, Kevin Parham was a 4-star guy. Nat Yasko was a 4-star guy. Solomon Hill was a 4-star guy. But sort of at the same time, you know, Lamont Jones is a 3-star guy. I mean, you just kind of look through, but none of those guys are really superstars.
Yeah, you're not seeing your 5-star. You know, you go back to 2003 and you've got Mustafa Shakur, who's a 5-star player, Kirk Walters, who, you know, is a 4-star player. You know, and they've definitely, you know, you look back to when they were taking guys out of Washington, like Jason Terry and Michael Dickerson. I mean, really some of the top players in the country going down there, Damon Stoudemire. But yeah, this is not that kind of class. It's kind of more of a class, I feel like, that you build on. And now, you know, next year they have Angelo Chol, who was pursued by everybody, a big man out of Sudan. He's going to Arizona. And this upcoming class for them is looking pretty good. I mean, Sean Miller, Pac-10 Coach of the Year, it's difficult to argue with that. I mean, I think you could make a case for a couple of other guys, but it is, I think, in a way, it's nice to see Arizona on top of the league because, you know, I kind of like this team. And on the other hand, it's also people in the country expect Arizona to be on top in the Pac-10, and it kind of, I think, signals a little bit more that, you know, kind of the traditional teams that are good in this league are, you know, are back at it.
Yeah, and it really is remarkable. I mean, you know, Miller's really getting a lot out of these guys. I even went back to the 2008 recruiting class. That was the class that was supposed to have Brandon Jennings, who left, and then Jeff Withey, who was supposed to be a pretty good center, who left. And sort of that class was left with Kyle Fogg and Brandon Lavender, both of which turned out to be really nice players. And so, and good defensive players too. And that I think is sort of the thing is, you know, Miller, I think, just did a really masterful job of sort of blending guys together. When you look at their percentage of minutes played and their usage percentages, really the only guy on their team playing over 70% of the available minutes is Derek Williams, which is sort of absurd. You know, most teams have a guard or two even who will be playing over 80%. And so you got Derek Williams at 72%. Nobody else is above 65%. Kyle Fogg's at 65%. Momo Jones at 63%. Solomon Hill at 59%. And it just kind of goes down from there. And then beyond that, when you look at their usage percentages, in other words, how many possessions end with the ball in their hand, a missed shot, an assist, a turnover, whatever, you know, Derek Williams is the only guy above 22. Everybody else, they've got a crap load of guys between like 17 and 22, which is really remarkable. I mean, what's that saying is that they really share the ball and they share minutes and they share the ball and they just sort of buy into that whole thing. And that to me is really remarkable. And I guess that's why, you know, for our, you know, when we put together our All Pac-10 team for our site, you know, I did end up voting for Miller. And I did, you mentioned that, you know, there were some other options out there. You know, I thought about Dana Altman. He was the one that I looked at probably most strongly. For me, I think, you know, we talked actually 2 weeks ago about how, look at Oregon, if they sweep Cal and Stanford at home, which seemed doable, all of a sudden they're going to be 9-7 heading into the last weekend of play. Well, they went and got swept at home by Cal and Stanford. And so that sort of tipped the scales for me. I mean, you know, I just sort of went, you know, they were right there. And then they just sort of fell off a little bit the last couple weekends. So to me, that sort of tipped the scale in Miller's favor. And just the fact that, you know, to do what he did with so many players who you would not consider elite, you know, there were guys almost or as good as Derek Williams and Clay Thompson and Isaiah Thomas. And, you know, you could make a case for Jorge Gutierrez, but, you know, none of those teams had the team success that Arizona was able to have, and I think Miller was sort of a big reason for that happening.
Yeah, and therefore the Arizona empirically wins the Pac-10 with the highest winning percentage and wins. And then we also got yesterday the subjective champions of the all Pac-10 first team, second team, freshman team, and defensive team.
Right.
What did you think, Jeff? Did you, you started to say you weren't so impressed with the first team picks.
Well, I have no problem with the overall picks. You know, it was Derek Williams, player of the year, absolutely deserved, totally earned it. And then, you know, Sean Miller, totally agreed with that. And defensive player of the year, I had no problem with Marcus Simmons. You know, but as I looked at that first team, there was one sort of, I think, majorly glaring problem, and that is the placement of Tyler Honeycutt on the first team. Nice player, good player, solid defender, and that makes a difference. But, you know, to me, it's like when you look at a guy, and, you know, I mean, everybody listens by now knows that, I'm very much into efficiency stats and things like that. His scoring efficiency is below average. His offensive rating is, I think, about 97, where average is 100. And when you're looking at that and you're looking at a guy who's not really a volume shooter either, and that's sort of the thing, like, you know, a lot of times you're willing to take a guy who's maybe not quite as efficient because he's carrying such a load for his team. A guy like Klay Thompson comes to mind. A guy like Jeremy Green comes to mind. You know, but when Klay Thompson last year, you know, whose offensive efficiency in conference was like 95. But that was, you know, coaches sort of said, hey, you know, much respect there because he's being expected to carry this team. You know, Tyler Honeycutt, he's not being expected to do that. He's not doing much of anything. He's not shooting well. He's not, you know, shooting about 32-33% on threes this year. I mean, why he would be on the first team other than sort of coaches being afraid of him going off, remembering Kansas, the Kansas game where he just took over. I mean, I don't really have a good explanation for why he would be included.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of guys, you know, that – you know, have his numbers that, you know, are sort of disruptive players. Jared Cunningham, you know, piled a bunch of numbers, but, you know, we talk about, you know, that he's in that system. You know, Justin Holiday, I feel like, is not that much different than Tyler Honeycutt necessarily, you know, and there are definitely some other guys. I don't know. I didn't, you know, I mean, I guess you have a 10-team first team, and it seemed like it was more kind of, you know, Honeycutt being kind of, like you said, scary to coaches in that he's such a matchup nightmare. And that's, I mean, that's something important to remember. It's the coaches that vote on this.
Right.
And, you know, as a basketball coach, you look at a guy who's 6'8", you know, who can handle the ball, can shoot, can defend the guards, can defend forwards. And you say, oh gosh, you know, like, how am I going to deal with this guy? And I think that was sort of what, you know, sort of tipped the scales in his favor.
Yeah, I don't have any arguments with the rest of it. I think the only change I would make is I would move Jovan Catron up to that first team. He had an amazingly efficient year, taking a lot of shots when he was on the floor. You know, he missed part of the beginning of the year with injury, but he was very, very good. Very, very good. And so that's the only change I would make. The rest of it, honestly, I don't have too much problem with. You know, I don't see, you know, you mentioned that, you know, Justin Holiday was an interesting one. When I did my voting for our site, we do first, second, third team, five-man teams since, you know, only five men play basketball at a time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's weird. I actually voted Justin Holiday onto my second team, and I put Honeycutt on my third team. Holiday was a much more efficient scorer in a similar amount of possessions and also, I think, the superior defender. I think, you know, Honeycutt is will block some shots, but I think Holiday's a superior all-around defender. So anyway, yeah, sort of pile on UCLA. I'm not, you know, I think Malcolm Lee absolutely deserved to be there. Reeves Nelson absolutely deserved to be there. I thought Honeycutt, I thought that was a curious choice. So I don't know. Second team, you have any issues with anybody on the second? I mean, you know, it's hard to
get. Yeah, I don't know. You know, they voted, obviously, you know, the coaches voted for who belongs in the first team. And then, you know, a bunch of guys got, you know, a certain number of votes. And I mean, I guess I was kind of surprised to see Casto up as high as he was, but
yeah,
in the second team, but shoot, you know, I mean, he again, is a guy who, you know, has a big impact on a game. So, you know, I don't know if I were picking necessarily picking 15 guys from the Pac-10 to be on a basketball team that I would necessarily pick him just because, you know, he can sort of on offense kind of be a problem. But, I mean, he is so good defensively. So, yeah, I think he sort of benefited from that same concept that Honeycutt did. But I think it's pretty much fine.
Yeah, the second team was Casto, Catron, Cunningham, Camp, and Lockett. And I think what that shows is that, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the conference being down. Well, I remember we had this conversation a year ago about, like, holy crap, you know, who on this list is going to play in the NBA? You know, we looked at the first team, we said, are any of these players NBA players?
Yeah, and Michael Roll.
Yeah. And so, you know, we were just sort of dumbfounded. Well, I think what you see now is that the talent level is coming back. You know, you look at this list, okay, who are the guys who could play in the Pac-10 or who could play in the NBA? You know, could Brian Amening play in the NBA? Yeah, probably. You know, he'll get a look. You know, Jeremy Green, he'll get a look. Gutierrez, you know, he'll probably get a look. Honeycutt, he'll definitely get a look. Malcolm Lee, Reeves Nelson, you know, Isaiah Thomas, Clay Thompson, Nikola Vucevic or Vucevic or whatever, he'll probably be the highest pick out of any of these guys. You know, and maybe higher than Derek Williams even, you know, because Derek Williams is a little undersized. So anyway, I guess the point is, you know, the talent is sort of returning, but then you look at that second team and it's like it sort of drops off pretty quickly. Mm. And I think Casto sort of benefited from that. The one thing I will say in defense of Casto is that he really came on offensively over the second half of the Pac-10 season. He actually has become a pretty reasonable offensive force. He's had a number of double doubles here in the last few weeks. You know, he's been strong. He's been strong and come on strong. And I think there's also a little bit of respect factor there. You know, he's guarding a taller guy every night. Every night. He's our only, as WSU, our only legitimate big man. You know, he's been a workhorse, and he really brings it every night. And I think the coaches sort of recognize what that is. The other honorable mention guys, just to cover real quick, Ty Abbott, Alan Crabb, Lamont Jones, Josh Owens from Stanford. So, you know, again, like we said, there's some nice young talent there on that second team, but, you know, Catron being a senior, Casto being a junior, but, you know, Camp's still a junior, Cunningham a sophomore, Lockett a sophomore, you know, Crabb a freshman there, honorable mention, Lamont Jones, sophomore, honorable mention, Josh Owens, junior. So there's still figures to be, you know, between the first and second teams, the only seniors were Matthew Brian Amening and Jovan Catron. And, you know, and some of those guys are probably going to leave. You know, Vucevic is probably going to leave. Derek Williams will probably leave. But still, the talent base, I guess what I'm getting at, is coming back. Let's take a look at the all-freshman team. Freshman of the year was Alan Crabb. Any problem with that?
Oh, no, I don't see who else, you know, you'd really pick there.
I might have gone with Josh Smith. And that's just, I think I have just
sort of. He only played like 10 minutes a game.
Yeah. Though. I mean, I have sort of an it was 20 minutes a game, but.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I have a little bit of an irrational man crush on him. I just have a soft spot for big men with soft hands and good feet, but.
From Kent.
From Kent. But, you know, but I could see both. I mean, I could definitely see both. I have no problem with Crabb whatsoever. My only issue is that he was sort of an offensive non-factor for quite a while this season, you know, really didn't shoot much, really didn't whatever. And so, you know, it's, if you were looking to, you know, nitpick, that would be a place to nitpick, but I certainly deserving, and his future is very bright. And I think Joshua Smith's future is very bright too. Other guys on that all freshman team, Anthony Brown, Maurice Jones from USC, Dwight Powell from Stanford, Joshua Smith, and then CJ Wilcox from Washington. So any problems with any of those, any issues there or anything you would see? Terrence Ross, honorable mention.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people, you know, Ken Bone even brought, I believe Ken Bone was who had been brought up Terrence Ross as a possible freshman of the year candidate.
Yeah.
You know, a couple weeks ago, and then he sort of ends up on the third, you know, at the end of the bench of the all freshman team, so to speak. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's weird to me. If I'm a Pac-10 coach right now, I don't know which of these guys other than I would pick Crabb and Joshua Smith over Ross, but I can't imagine anyone taking any of the other guys, you know, potentially. I'm not sure, actually. But, you know, I mean, Ross is so much offensive talent. But, you know, he couldn't stay on the floor because of his frequent defensive lapses that, you know, were not always as apparent, I don't think.
Right.
To fans, you know, you sort of had to like watch Lorenzo Romar's body language from the stands, to see, you know, when Ross was screwing up. So he wasn't able to stay on the floor that much, and he had a couple of good games. I assume one of the people that voted for him was Kevin O'Neill after he torched UCLA for 20 points. But then he didn't play in the game against UCLA, last game of the year. So, I don't know, hard to put a guy on the all freshman team who his coach doesn't even think is worthy of playing a game at the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd go with that, but I mean, I also think that's sort of the nature of freshmen, you know. I mean, they're gonna play well and they're gonna screw up, and you know, unless there's somebody really special, they're gonna have major issues. I mean, I think that's as much a testament to Crabb as anything that, you know, he was able to come in and play the kind of minutes he did. When I did my voting on the freshman team for our site, I had Terrence Ross on the team and I had Maurice Jones off. So, you know, and I thought, Maurice Jones, I think he deserves a lot of credit for the number of minutes he played and, you know, demanding position, you know, basically playing point guard. But at the same time, he was a really bad offensive player, like a really, really bad offensive player. And so, I just sort of wasn't able to overlook. I guess I was just sort of like, you know, if USC wasn't so thin, you know, wasn't so talent thin, would a guy that ineffective ever have seen the floor that much? And so, you know, and my answer in my head was probably not. So, you know, I guess I'm not going to reward a guy just for playing a crap load of minutes because his coach didn't really have any other choice. You know, Terrence Ross, if he was playing for Washington State, would have played 30 minutes a night, regardless of all of his defensive screw-ups. You know, so I guess I thought, you know, he had a really nice season. In the pecking order, I sort of put, you know, Crabb, Smith, Wilcox, and then I sort of went, you know, Ross was sort of at the top of that third tier of guys, I guess, you know, with like Dwight Powell. I had Dwight Powell on my team too, so he's a really promising big man. Defensive team, defensive player of the year was Marcus Simmons. I got no problem with that. D'Angelo Casto, Jared Cunningham, Jorge Gutierrez, Malcolm Lee, and Marcus Simmons all on that first team. Only guy I have an issue with there, and I will forever have an issue with, is the coaches voting anybody who plays at the top of Oregon State's defense, racking up those trap steals onto an all-defensive team. Although I will say this, they did get smart and not vote him the defensive player of the year this year like they did last year. So I guess that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a tricky – I mean, you know, what do you say? It's sort of similar to the Momo Jones thing where – or not Momo Jones, but Maurice Jones where, you know, I mean, he's going to rack up those steals just like Maurice Jones is going to rack up points just based on sort of the position he has and – you know, how he's used on the floor. I mean, I can imagine a situation where, I mean, what would be, how many steals would that guy have to get for you to say, okay, he's a good defensive player, like 150?
Well, here's my issue. Every guy who plays at the top of that zone racks up crap loads of steals.
Right. It's, but I mean, it doesn't matter who it is. They have to be a long, fast guy. You couldn't, you know, you put, you know, I mean,
sure. Okay. So let's
sample up there. He's not going to get that many steals.
Sure.
He's not fast.
Okay, so here's a hypothetical then. Okay, WSU fans tend to think that Marcus Capers is a pretty good defender. I tend to think he's not as good of a defender as our fans seem to think he is.
Yeah.
But what if I take Marcus Capers and I put him at the top of that zone? Is he now an elite defender? And I mean, I guess defense is about positioning and about stopping somebody.
You're saying that's not defense, basically. That's just playing keep away.
Yeah, and it's exactly, and it's probably it's probably a little bit of bias on my part. I mean, I have a bias. I probably have a little bit of a bias against junk defenses, you know, because I look at what Oregon State is doing, and I look at their overall offensive or their overall defensive efficiency in conference, and when you take a guy and you put him on the all defense team and his team playing that junk defense, which he is benefiting from statistically, that junk defense is allowing 1.05 points per possession, eighth worst in conference play. That to me just sort of says, you know, I guess that's like giving the Heisman to a quarterback who's on a 6-6 spread option team who throws for 72 touchdowns. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I just go, you know, you're, defense is mediocre. You're racking up tons of stats and steals just out of because you happen to be the guy.
Well, hold on then. In that case, I mean, what about Casto? I mean, Wazoo's defense was not that great. and he blocks a lot of shots, I mean, is he hurting their defense by, you know, going for blocks and getting out of position? Or,
well,
you know.
On the contrary, Washington State's defense was fourth best in the conference.
Oh, were they?
Fourth best in conference play, 1.0 points per possession, which isn't anything stellar. But I think that says more about sort of the state of defense in the conference. Yes. But at the same time, you know, the defense was average-ish. You know, the defense was average.
Yeah.
And actually, he actually blocked fewer shots this year than he did last year at a lower rate. And I think that's because he was much more sound assignment-wise. He was much better at not trying to just block everything in sight. Because one of the big issues that I had with him last year was, I mean, he just tried to block everything in sight. And then obviously, so the guy misses the shot, which is great. But then the guy that Casto was supposed to be boxing out then easily cleans up the rebound and puts it right back. And so I think it's sort of a testament to him that, you know, he was much more disciplined about which shots to try and block, stayed home much more often, was you didn't see really an increase in his rebound rate stats, but at the same time, you know, he was much better boxing out. He actually enabled other people to get rebounds by boxing guys out well. And so I think coaches sort of recognized all that. And then the natural challenge of, you know, basically guarding a bigger guy every night. And having to do that. And so I think sort of all of that was played together. But and I also just don't see, you know, he wasn't benefiting from a system. You know, I just feel like you could plug, you know, any guy who's long and lanky and springy out into the top of that trap, and they're going to get a ton of steals. And that's not to say that, you know, Cunningham's not a good player, because he is. He's a really nice young player. I mean, he's probably the most athletic guy in the conference. But at the same time, you know, let's not call him a great defender because he happens to benefit from a system that generates steals but gives up a lot of easy buckets.
Well, like if you put – now, sir, for example, one guy that was on the first team – well, actually, there are two Huskies that were on the first team last year who were also played this year but did not make the first team.
Right.
Justin Holliday, who ended up being an honorable mention, who I think if you put at the top of the Oregon State zone might – create some sort of like world panic attack with getting like a 500 steals.
Exactly.
And then, I mean, I don't know exactly where do you say, I mean, did Justin Holliday get worse? Did some of these other guys get better than Justin Holliday? I'm not really sure what the thinking was there.
Well, that would have been my one switch. I would have put Holliday on the first team, taken Cunningham off, and I would have been okay with that.
And then Old Vannoy Overton, the pest,
yes,
off the team entirely this year. The Pac-10 all-time active steals leader in the conference, you know, but not this year. And he was ninth in steals, so, you know, I mean, I guess that's reasonable.
Yeah, that was sort of interesting. I mean, I think there was a perception among fans that maybe he wasn't as strong defense. I mean, how did UW fans feel? How did you guys feel about his contributions this year compared to, say, last year?
Well, you know, I mean, he had to play a different role after Abdul-Ghadi went out. I mean, well, after Abdul-Ghadi went out, he was one of two ball handlers on the team. And therefore, you know, he's not going to be he can't get in as much. He's got to stay out of foul trouble, basically. Whereas before, you know, it was okay for him to come in and hassle guys and get in their faces and make him pick up a foul or two, but it was worth it in that he'd get a couple of steals or intimidate the opposing point guard or intimidate the referees. This year, he just couldn't do as much of that. Always said he tried to do as much. You know, he wasn't changing his style or whatever. I just don't find that. I find that pretty hard to believe. So, and then there were moments. There were times when. Yeah, he wasn't as effective, and therefore he was playing less because sort of, I mean, I guess kind of almost as a, it's like sort of a catch-22, but he was less effective because he was more valuable to the team, and therefore because he was less effective when he was on the floor, they were using Isaiah Thomas more and using some of the other guys who were better scorers. I mean, if you're not getting good defense out of Vannoy Overton, he's not really a good scorer, so, you know, why is he really on the floor? Just basically was used to spell Isaiah Thomas, and you know he had some, you know he had some good defensive games and made some good plays, and you know had some good offensive games too. But yeah, he definitely wasn't that disruptive force that he was in previous years.
Yeah, if you just take his rate stats in a vacuum, he was stealing passes at roughly the same rate that he was last year. Mm. And he was actually committing fewer fouls per 40 minutes than he was last year. Not by much. It was 5.0 fouls per 40 to 4.7 this year. But, you know, so he's fouling a little bit less, stealing about the same. My cougar colored glasses want to say that coach has finally caught on to his shtick and that but I mean, you know, that's a rival fan talking, obviously, about, you know, a guy and sort of my issues with him were beyond sort of everything with, I just felt like elite defenders don't foul as much as he does and they don't get beat as much as he does. I know he's disruptive and I gave him all the credit in the world. I think we talked about this last year. You know, I said all the credit in the world for being disruptive within what Washington wants him to do. But that to me doesn't say elite defender. Elite defender.
Well, similar to what you're saying with Cunningham.
Exactly.
That, you know, he's got a role to play and he's playing that role, but he's not playing, you know, what you would strictly call, you know, basketball defense. I mean, he's really in there trying to either, you know, trying to disrupt the offense. And if that means he's playing too close to the guy, reaching for a steal, the guy gets around him and, you know, and gets fouled or gets a lay in, then that's okay because that's, you know, sort of what he's supposed to be doing. But he's not really playing, you know, it's a similar role to Cunningham's really. And then he's in there to sort of try to get steals and try to disrupt the opposing offense.
Right.
You could have anyone in that role. I mean, theoretically.
Yeah. And, you know, credit to, you know, I almost have to think of, you know, this is probably a good segue into the Pac-10 tournament as well. You know, I almost have to wonder a little bit how much the off the court stuff sort of played into it. And, you know, now that some charges have been filed, I guess we can sort of talk about this.
We can finally talk about it.
You know, we sort of said the unnamed player. Well, you know, there was a legal issue surrounding the University of Washington earlier this year. And, you know, were rape charges going to be filed or not filed and sort of all this. So we sort of danced around who the player was, even though I think most people sort of knew if they cared to look hard enough. Well, it comes down today that Vannoy Overton has in fact been charged with furnishing alcohol to a minor in that incident. He was not charged with any kind of sexual misconduct. However, you know, it certainly seems at the very least sort of poor judgment. I don't know. You know, it's sort of not cool, I guess, to get some 16-year-olds drunk. I mean, as a high school teacher, I'm sort of like, you know. So I almost have to wonder before we sort of get into what ramifications that suspension might have, maybe coaches also sort of – I mean, the coaches would have known who this was a long time ago, and I almost wonder if they sort of held back their vote as a, you know, hey, this isn't cool. So I don't know.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, and, you know, I brought up as a hypothetical to you if, you know, Klay Thompson had been one of the top candidates for Pac-10 Player of the Year, and then that marijuana bust had happened, what would happen? And you immediately responded, well, he wouldn't have won Pac-10 Player of the Year. And I mean, it's the same thing, you know. I mean, maybe in the back of their heads, that's, you know, that's there. It's odd for a guy to go from, but I mean, three coaches did vote for him. So, oh wait, no, they didn't. He didn't make honorable mention at all. I don't know. I mean, it's odd for, especially a thing like all defense team, which ends up being so much about reputation. To me, it's odd for a guy to like go from on the team to off the team. So yeah, I mean, it could very well have, you know, that could very well have been kept him off that team, which is, you know, another reason not to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So he's suspended for the entire Pac-10 tournament while Klay Thompson is back with the Cougars. And I don't know. Should we just – oh, wait. We're going to talk about – so Washington's probably one of the favorites to win that conference tournament as one of the six teams that does not have to play in the play-in day.
Right.
So the first two games of the Pac-10 tournament are Wednesday. You have Stanford, the number 8 seed, against Oregon State. The number 9 seed is the first game. Oregon, number 7, against number 10 ASU, is the second game that day. Oregon State had sort of an interesting final game of the season. They had 9 guys suspended for missing curfew, so they only had 6 players, only one of whom was a guard. It was Roberto Nelson, who sort of unleashed for the first time this season, had 34 points. Seems like kind of think there's some weird things going on down there. Who knows? But it's sort of been an ugly, ugly season for Oregon State and, could potentially end on a very, very ugly note against Stanford.
Yeah, I think that's one game where, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Oregon State made some noise, and I wouldn't be surprised if they completely flamed out. And I guess that's sort of been their MO all season. You know, looking over at the other game tomorrow on Wednesday, you've got Oregon and Arizona State. I think, you know, both of us would say probably we expect Oregon to win that game. But, you know, I guess that's – could you see a scenario where Arizona State is able to break through and pick up another Pac-10 win, even though they only got a couple during the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to see. I mean, on the other hand, they did beat Oregon by 20 points on Thursday. So, you know, they have three wins in their past five games.
Yeah, that's
true.
They
had a pretty nice string against the Oregon schools this weekend. So, you know, maybe they're starting to turn it on, or maybe they're just sort of starting to get desperate. It's sort of unclear at this point. You know, they had a tough year with injuries, guys having to play hurt. I would guess Oregon will win that game. And the winner of that game would face UCLA on Thursday, with the winner of Stanford, Oregon State facing Arizona.
Yeah.
Do you see any, Oregon State, has played fairly well against Arizona, if memory serves. I don't know. I guess they lost to him. They beat him 76-75.
Beat him up in Corvallis, yep.
And they've had, I feel like, pretty good luck with them in the past few years. Of course, a lot of teams have. They swept them the year before last. So, I mean, maybe that's one to look out for.
Yeah, I mean, maybe let me ask you this question. Do you see any of those first four that are playing those, you know, sort of quasi play-in games, I guess, you know, on Wednesday, do you see any of those four teams as being capable of making any kind of a deep run? Like, and by deep run, maybe, like, I don't know, making the semis, winning two games and making the semis, knocking out
either Arizona
or UCLA.
Somebody's going to win one game. One of them's going to win one game. Yeah, I don't know. Oregon State seems just like they're kind of a mess right now. I would think if there's a team that, you know, just because ASU and Oregon State kind of play those weird defenses, although Oregon State's been doing a little less of it this year, you know, you'd think that neither Arizona and UCLA kind of want to get in like a grinded out game against, you know, Oregon State or ASU, who feel to me kind of like, whenever I think about college basketball, I always tend to think of it now as like seeds, you know, in the tournament. I mean, I feel like Oregon State and ASU, if they were in, you know, the Sun Belt or some dinky conference, they'd probably win it. And they'd be, you know, like a 14 or 15 or a 13 seed in the NCAA tournament, you know, playing some grinded out defensive style. And those are the teams that you really, you know, you really don't want to watch. They're usually ugly games and, you know, playing for, you know, I mean, every coach and, you know, Oregon State and ASU is going to say, listen, guys, we'll have to win four games and we're in the tournament and here's our chance and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, they sort of go for all it's worth. And, if I'm Arizona and UCLA, I don't want to see Oregon State or ASU, although I feel like those are probably the teams that are least likely to win those quarterfinal games.
Right. Yeah, I don't see any of them really being capable. I don't know that any of them are, you know, capable of putting together two decent games in 2 days, you know, and I look at things like motivation or whatever. I mean, I guess if I was going to pick a likely upset candidate, I guess I would have to go with UCLA just because UCLA nearly got beat by Washington State without Klay Thompson, without Reggie Moore, and with two walk-ons playing 20 minutes apiece. So one of which was a freshman. So, you know, I guess I would say if I was going to try to pick a team that I thought could win a couple games, I would say Oregon, simply because I think that they've sort of demonstrated that they can play at a high level this year. They do have, I think, more weapons than – I mean, I guess maybe you could say they – I don't know. Their weapons are maybe comparable to Oregon State, but anyway, it's, you know, they've got Jovan Catron. They've got, you know, some different guy, you know, Singler, who's been a pretty good player actually for them this year. I mean, they've got some weapons, and then UCLA sort of, has this habit of looking past people. And so I would not be shocked if, you know, do I expect him to win? No, but I mean, I'd not be shocked if Oregon could pull off a couple wins in a row to face, the winner of Washington, Washington State in the semis. And of course, Washington playing without Overton, Washington State getting Klay Thompson back from his pot suspension, which was sort of the big news of the end of last week. Reggie Moore injured his ankle on Thursday against USC. He's expected to play now. So I don't know, Husky fan, are you terrified of losing a third time to us, or do you feel like, you know, the first two were somewhat fluky and that you're sort of ready to bust out? Because when I think of a team that's sort of a mess, I sort of think of Washington.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I guess it was what, two or three, was it 2008, I want to say, it was 2008 or was it 2007? One of those years that Huskies played, lost to Washington State three times, and one of those was in the turn. Yeah, it was the semi for the quarterfinals in 2007, and the Cougars beat the Huskies for a third time. Different Cougar team, different Cougar style completely. But you know, you thought going to that game, oh God, you know, okay, but they beat us twice, but they're not going to beat us a third time. And of course they did. It came down to, I think it was overtime, but, yeah, I mean, challenging for Washington. Overton's suspended and out for the Pac-10 tournament, and that really leaves them with one ball handler, Isaiah Thomas, and they'll be at a disadvantage there. You know, you're always worried about Thompson getting hot. Now he's been reinstated. He's going to play in that game. So, you know, I think they'll beat Washington State. I mean, I'm sure they're favored to beat Washington State, but I certainly wouldn't say confident.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, it's, that's the game. I feel like of any game, that game has the most implications. Right now, the Huskies are pretty firmly on the bubble. They're like an average 10 seed in all the brackets that all the mock bracket averages. So, you know, I think a lot of people feel like if they lose that game, depending on what happens, you know, elsewhere in the world, that could push them off the bubble.
Yeah, and I know when WSU beat Washington those three times back in whatever it was, 2007, I just know, like, from my perspective watching it, I felt like, oh yeah, we're going to beat them that third time. Like, we're just the better team, even though, you know, it's sort of Washington had dominated us up until that year. I just felt like the style, the everything, just that was, I just felt like Washington State had their number. I don't feel that way this year. It's weird. You know, yeah, we've won both games, but I also feel like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just sort of feel like the first one, you know, Washington missed a crap load of shots. The second one, Washington missed a crap load of shots. And I don't know that I would attribute what percentage of that I would attribute to Washington State's defense. So I don't, you know, of all the teams that I wanted to see a third time, Washington was actually pretty low on the list. But again, you know, they're sort of searching for themselves, and you've got a motivated Klay Thompson, you know, which should be interesting, you know, because he obviously feels somewhat responsible for the loss to UCLA, which really would have gotten the Cougars back into the NCAA tournament conversation. But I think the Cougars even still feel like, you know, if they can get to the finals, even if they don't win the berth outright, I think they feel like if they can get to the finals, they'll put themselves back in the conversation. So that is fairly interesting. And then on the other half of the bracket, you've got a team that I think feels like they should be in the conversation. Two teams, actually, in USC and Cal. I think they both feel like, hey, you know, what about us? You know, everybody sort of talks about, you know, Washington State being on the fringe. USC is in the conversation. I know Lunardi, who's, you know, not my favorite bracketology guy, but, you know, I think he had USC in his first four out in his latest mock, you know, and Cal, I think, is sort of, you know, feels like, hey, look at us. You know, we won 10 games in conference. And so, you know, and USC, of course, has some quality wins to their resume that pretty much nobody else in the conference has. How do you see that game shaken out? And how do you give either one of those teams a chance to perhaps make a run past Arizona, who's in their half of the bracket, to the final?
Well, they played each other twice, and the total combined difference was 5 points. Cal winning by two at USC, and then USC winning by three at Cal. So they've played each other pretty even, and at a kind of faster pace than, you know, you'd sort of expect from USC. I think I think, but you know, both teams are sort of, you know, they, like you said, they're sort of motivated to get in the picture there. But I expect it's going to be one of those like really close, like really hotly contested games where, you know, both teams are really, you know, playing for, you know, I mean, it's an NCAA tournament game basically for both teams. It's sort of a play-in for them for the NCAA tournament, both from an at-large berth perspective and from a, you know, if they can win it, they can get in kind of perspective. So, you know, you'll probably see as they wear each other out, go to three overtimes, and then get blasted by Arizona the next day, but who knows?
That's sort of my thought. I don't, you know, a lot of times I try to look for reasons why the top seed isn't going to win it, you know, because a lot of times the top seed doesn't win it. But I look at Arizona and I go, that is a team who's actually built to win this sort of tournament, just like Washington was last year. You know, elite scorer, elite player who can get his shot anytime he wants, pretty much. And then a very deep team that can win three games in 3 days. And so, yeah. You know, I think that Arizona can do that. I don't think USC can do that. And I don't know that Cal can do that, because Cal does have some reasonable semblance of a bench, but they do rely awful hard on Jorge Gutierrez. And so I just, again, you know, sort of wonder, you know, whether they can do it. USC, though, has surprised me. I mean, I made a big deal earlier this year about the Trojans, and they're going to wear down because Kevin O'Neill rides his horses way too hard and all of these things. And I looked sort of smart when they lost, what was it, about 6 out of 9 games there from about the middle of January to the middle of February. And then all of a sudden they go and make me look really dumb by winning 5 of their last 6. So, you know, and their only loss being over in Pullman last Thursday. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe.
Roll, but I always feel like teams on a roll are, you know, usually due to fall. So, like you said, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, UCLA and Cal both, you know, both ride players, their point guard especially, pretty hard. And Washington's another team. Well, and shoot, Washington State for that matter.
Yeah.
Both teams that, I mean, especially Washington though right now, because it's hard to imagine. I mean, Isaiah Thomas, it's difficult to see where he's going to be able to play any less than 38, 37 minutes a game in any game that they play the rest of the way, or at least in this tournament, because Overton's out. They do not have another ball handler. They have a walk-on, but they, you know, he's not going to play. So, you know, he's going to have to play 37 minutes. Gutierrez, I'm sure, will play 37. I'm sure Jones will. I mean, Gutierrez probably played 40, and Maurice Jones has played 40 a few times this year. So,
right.
You know, 3 games in 3 days. Oh, you know, that's for a point guard. I feel like that's pretty rough.
So let's maybe put this last question out there. So do you agree with me that Arizona looks like the favorite at this point? Is that who you would pick as your favorite?
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, I especially given the fact that if they play Washington, which I mean, the Huskies blew Arizona out in at UW and only lost by, you know, a point or like barely at Arizona. And I, you know, if the two teams were to play straight up on a neutral court with, you know, Washington, with their full complement of players, I'd feel pretty strongly about the Huskies winning that game. But the fact that Arizona wouldn't get the Huskies until the final after they'd played 2 games and Isaiah Thomas's, you know, quads are probably like, you know, burning. I think they'll be really, if they do make the final, I think they'll be really, I mean, they'll be looking at a really high seed in the tournament. So, yeah, I think Arizona probably, I mean, hell, they're the number one seed. So, shoot, they should win it, I guess. But like you said, the number one seed typically doesn't. So,
okay, so let's take Arizona out of the equation. Who do you think is the most likely from, say, you know, that group of teams that are still sort of fighting, you know, the USC, USC, Cal, Washington State, and let's even take UCLA out of the equation. And let's just say out of those four sort of second tier teams, which of those would you say you would place the highest odds on of having the best chance to win, to actually make a run and win this thing and sort of secure that third bid for the league?
Well, you know, if I weren't, you know, I am a big Husky homer, but you know, and it's sort of obviously the 3 seed, and they're have the best chance. I don't think I would pick them if there were another team in that grouping that didn't sort of face the same challenges the Huskies do, in as far as you know, their players wearing out. You know, Wazoo's isn't very deep. USC is the opposite of deep. And, you know, and Cal really has a couple of players that they rely on really heavily. So, I think of that group probably Washington, just because of their depth at the wing spot, at least. They have some depth somewhere, which I don't really think any of those other teams can say. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
To go all the way and win it, yeah.
Yeah, I think if I was going to say which team was most likely, I think I'd still have to go with Washington. I just, you know, I know that they've had their troubles or whatever, but like you said, you know, they're deep, they're experienced for the most part. You know, they're not as experienced as I think some people think, given the minutes that, you know, say CJ Wilcox plays and whatever. But at the same time, it's sort of like, you know, they've got guys who have been there before. This is a team that is sort of slipping to the bubble. You know, I didn't feel like, you know, them losing to Washington was some sort of systemic thing. You know, I just felt like they sort of shot poorly in the first one, shot poorly and got outworked in the second one. I don't know if that's going to happen a third time. So I think of all those teams, I would definitely, I think, put it on Washington and for them to make a run and win this thing, because the talent is certainly still there. So, Seth, I think we about covered it all.
I think so. Yeah, I think we do. I mean, it should be, you know, it should be a fun weekend. And, you know, so definitely, you know, three teams for sure. And maybe the Huskies as a fourth, you know, needing to make a big showing to advance onto the NCAA tournament.
Yeah. So I think we will all be watching interested. And I know that, you know, I enjoy this time of year probably only slightly less than the actual NCAA tournament itself, because I've spent way too much time in front of my television the last few days with my Xbox and my ESPN3 subscription and just watching every little dinky tournament around the country and every game that I could. It's been fantastic. So really interested to see how the Pac-10 tournament plays out. Interested to see the Pac-10 get its sort of moment in the regional sun, given that nobody's actually going to watch it on FSN except for those of us out here. So pretty cool. I'm excited for it. I'm excited to see what the Cougars do. You know, this is the first time in a while I felt like the team could legitimately maybe make a little bit of a run and actually do something special. So, and I think that's something that's going to be fun to watch in this tournament, because I think there are a lot of teams, and I think there are at least, you know, four or five teams, I think, that are in that position where you could make legitimate cases for them making a run. So should be fun to watch. That'll do it for us this week on 18 in Life, the Pac-10 Hoops podcast. Make sure and check us out on Twitter at twitter.com/18nlifehoops, or you can interact with us. Send us your thoughts at 18nlifehoops@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts on your team or on the Pac-10 tournament or on the NCAA selection. In a week or so, we'll be back with you after Selection Sunday, talking about the teams that made it to the tournament from the Pac-10, talking about what their prospects are going to be over the weekend, and just sort of recapping the Pac-10 tournament and previewing the NCAA tournament. So for my co-host, Seth Colin, my name is Jeff Neusser with a crying baby in the background. Thanks for joining us on 18 in Life. We'll talk to you next week.